I'm Renee. I am the YouTube creator liaison.
And I'm Todd. I lead the product team for growth and discovery at YouTube.
So how does the recommendation system actually work?
So the first thing that creators should understand is that the recommendation systems are really centered around each individual viewer. Okay. So oftentimes creators will say, hey, the recommendation system is pushing out my video to people.
Or why isn't it pushing out my video to people?
Yes, they may ask that. And the way it works is it isn't so much about pushing it out as much as it's pulling for each viewer. So when you open the homepage, YouTube is going to say, hey, Renee's here. We need to give Renee the best content that is going to make Renee happy today. It's very much centered around each individual person and ranking the videos for them, as opposed to looking at each individual video and trying to figure out who might like it.
So there could be videos, like a video could have these absolute metrics, like its click-through rate, its view duration, all of that, but you might like it and I might not, and you would consider that when you recommend
it. So a lot of creators, they look at their analytics and they're very focused on their aggregate performance because that's the easiest thing that we can kind of present. But the way the system's working is actually, it's not just using that average view duration or the average click-through rate, it's using the performance data as input, but ultimately trying to understand and predict for each viewer. It's kind of similar to how recommendations work outside of recommendation systems. When you want to figure out a movie to watch, one thing that I do is I talk to my friends and I say, hey, what have you seen lately? What do you want to see? And the recommendation system, sometimes we describe it as automating word of mouth.
I love that.
And by that we mean the system is able to understand what other viewers like you have watched, and then based on understanding what they enjoyed and what they didn't, it can help when it's time to give recommendations to you to pull in sort of like those recommendations from other people. The nice thing about it is that can come in multiple waves. Yeah. So maybe like right now there's a video that reaches a certain audience, but then like in 6 months, there's something else that's related that pops up that makes this video relevant again. Fortunately, you know, our system is enabled to be able to recommend that again if it's relevant and maybe to a different audience than enjoyed it the first time.
You've given me examples of that in the past where somebody will search for like a certain kind of video and find one and you'll be able to identify more audience, or something will pop up in the news and suddenly people are more interested in it, or a big creator will make a video on it and then people will see that and say, like, all these new ways where videos can find new audiences.
Yeah, sometimes it's just a matter of like nostalgia as well, where there's just been enough time since people have thought about something, and then somebody kind of rediscovers some trend or concept and they want to go back and kind of relive it through watching videos about that thing, and you see a resurgence of something that hasn't been popular for a while.
How much do you think about factors like time of day or device type? Like if I'm on my phone in the morning versus whether I'm on the television at night?
The recommendation system uses time of day and device as some of the signals that we learn from to understand if there's different content that is appealing in those different contexts. And so as a viewer, you can see different results at the same time on your television versus on your mobile phone, as well as different results in the morning versus the day. We try to identify if you tend to have a preference for like watching news in the morning and comedy at night. We'll try to lean into that. We'll try to learn from other viewers like you if they have that pattern, so that we could see if that works well for you. And all of it comes together to really just give the right content to the right viewer at the right time.
We often hear from creators, like, what's the one number? Like, is it click-through rate? Is it watch time? How do creators like optimize for all of these factors?
One thing to understand is that there's no single answer to that question, as much as creators would love to have one. The reality is that we've enabled the system to learn that different factors can have different importance in different contexts. Watch time may be more important in television versus mobile, or it may be more important in certain types of content like podcasts as opposed to music. Like, does it really matter whether a music video is 4 minutes and 30 seconds versus 4 minutes in terms of a viewer satisfaction? Maybe watch time isn't really as important as something like a like. In that context.
Sometimes when people hear about algorithms, they conflate that with just like engagement at all costs. But one of the things I love about YouTube is that it doesn't seem laser focused on just getting the maximum amount of engagement possible.
Yeah. So, you know, for quite a few years now, we've learned that not all time spent with video is equally valued by our viewers. We get feedback that viewers want some videos to be a lot more efficient in getting to the point and the value that they get from them. And so while we do look at how long people watch videos, it's only one of the factors that we consider when understanding the value people are getting. We introduced this concept of satisfaction quite a few years ago, where we're trying to understand not just about the viewer's behavior and what they do, but how do they feel about the time they're spending? What would they say about their experience watching a video? We ask them directly with surveys built into the product. We collect millions of responses and feed that directly into the recommendation system so that we can recognize when creators are delivering kind of more value per minute or more total value than maybe the time spent would indicate otherwise. And so we look at things like likes, dislikes, these survey responses. People can tell us they're not interested in certain recommendations. We have a variety of different signals to get at this satisfaction. And we've seen that when we add those signals into the ranking, that it actually leads to people coming back to YouTube more in the long run. And that's really what our goal is. It's not just to get suck a lot of time from you today. That's not the point. The point is, like, we want to build a relationship with our audience just as creators want to do with their fans, so that, you know, we can have viewers keep coming back because we're delivering a lot of value to them in the long run.
So for creators, do you think it's less important to look at absolute, like, what's your CTR, what's your watch time, and more like how they're currently performing and how they can improve based on their metrics and not like a universal sense of metrics?
Yeah, I think creators seek out benchmarks because they want to know, like, is this good? I totally understand that. Unfortunately, like, the reality with the way the metrics work and, you know, the fact that they're kind of dependent on who saw the video and how broadly it was distributed, it's really, you know, the ultimate CTR you get or the ultimate absolute watch time you get, it's not really comparable, like, across channels. And it's even, you know, sometimes challenging to interpret when you're comparing across videos within the same channel. You know, increasingly, while we do provide those metrics, I would take a step back and also think about your higher level goal as a creator.
Yeah.
And oftentimes creators talk to us about views, they talk to us about building up subscribers, or maybe they have goals that are about, you know, selling merchandise or something else. And, you know, maybe for those goals, the number of views you're getting is ultimately what you care about.
Or the quality of the views or the conversion rate of the views or, yeah.
Right. And so if you are struggling a bit with the depths of, you know, all the different types of data, maybe just take a step back and say, okay, well, you know, just as one example, would you, as a creator, rather have a video that has a 20% CTR and 10,000 views?
Yeah.
Or a 5% CTR and 100,000 views?
Yeah, absolutely. The second.
Right. Which video do you think was better?
The video with 5% and well, I'd have to look at a lot more metrics to give you a real answer to that.
Yeah. I mean, as a creator, I would be satisfied with a video that reached a larger audience. I might be looking at, you know, is there an opportunity to reach an even larger audience by making the thumbnail, you know, more appealing?
Yeah.
But given that it's achieved my goal, that's probably the most important part in terms of, like, comparing those two videos. And so, you know, don't forget to take a step back and look at the big picture, because those view numbers and those impression numbers, they encapsulate, you know, all the factors that go into the recommendation system. So if it's performing relatively well in terms of CTR versus other videos that your audience or the new audience might be interested in, it's going to end up getting more impressions because it's going to rank higher in the feed.
Yeah.
What about multi-language audio? We have creators now who, for example, are uploading the main language, the first language, and then a week later uploading a dub track. How are you thinking about recommendations in a multi-language, sometimes asynchronous world?
When we first started enabling creators to upload different audio tracks or dubs, as some people call them, we needed to add some new capabilities to our system in the recommendation side to make them aware that this video actually is available in multiple languages. So that was one thing that we did to start enabling those to reach different audiences. And then the next thing that we did for multi-track audio was to set up a feedback loop so that we could learn different signals for each track independently. Rather than just understanding the video across languages, we want to know, oh, well, this is working especially well in this particular language, but not so well in this other language. And so we set up those feedback loops to learn from that performance. So if you're a creator who's interested in extending your reach through dubs, what I'd recommend you do is a couple things. First, make sure that your titles and descriptions, that you're also uploading translated titles and descriptions so that when we recommend or return and search these videos in different languages, users can see those and know what they would be clicking on. The second thing is to recognize that there's benefits from having more of your catalog available in a particular language. So when a viewer does discover your channel, they can watch more than just like one video.
Yeah.
The more catalog that they have to choose from, the more likely it is that they'll find another video that they'll enjoy watching, which is a great signal back to us that you provided great value. So we've seen in particular creators who dub at least 80% of the viewership of their channel, I think it's watch time, tend to have more success than those who dub less. Recognize that there's kind of a critical mass in terms of offering a catalog in a language. So you might want to focus on, you know, getting to that like 80% of your catalog within a few languages rather than doing like 20% with more languages.
Yeah, and that's like current catalog based on watch time. It doesn't really matter. You don't have to go back 8 years, but like the things people are currently watching.
That's right.
I think that's great because you've talked before about the power of series and giving viewers a journey and the ability to have things that they're going to, if they love this video, what's the next thing they're going to want to watch for you? And that just seems to translate into the multi-language as well. We talked previously about like the recommendation system and sometimes views can go down for videos. We sometimes hear creators talk about views going down channel-wide as well. What are some of the things you look to when creators are talking about ebbs and flows in views?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is that it's natural. And just because your views on your channel are going down in a particular period doesn't mean that like your channel is going to die and go to zero. We see many waves of interest in channels where, you know, audiences might, you know, kind of binge for a while on a particular channel and then move on to other channels for a while. And many channels that go down quite a bit will then come back up quite a bit. Unfortunately, we don't hear as much from creators when their channel is like blowing up. No one complains, but then when it goes back to goes back down, you know, creators get concerned. But so the first thing is to just recognize this is natural. It's not particularly reasonable to expect that you're going to always be at your highest level of views from all time. That doesn't mean that it's the end of the career. It could just mean that wasn't as good as your all-time best. So it's normal. I would encourage you not to worry about it too much and just focus on what can you do to, you know, continue to evolve, respond to the feedback you're getting from your audience and from the analytics. Sometimes you may need to move on from a particular format or topic that has worked well for you in the past because the audience has been saturated on that particular area.
A couple of things you've told me have been very helpful. One is don't just look at the current month in analytics, but go out to the year to see if maybe there are spikes and returns to normal, or a couple years to look at seasonality.
Yes, we do see seasonality can play a role. Encourage you to look beyond, you know, 90 days or more to kind of see the full context. Oftentimes, you know, we saw some creators that, you know, saw a nice boost in demand around the election in the U.S. earlier this year. And then, you know, people moved on to watch other things after the election happened. And so think about some of those external dynamics. I encourage folks to use Google Trends to look at, you know, you can see trends in how often people are searching on YouTube for particular topics. And while that isn't all, doesn't always tell the whole story, it can give you one interesting signal about just like how much demand there is in a particular area. The other thing to keep in mind is the other side of the ecosystem is supply. Supply and demand. On the supply side, we do see, you know, dynamics that happen where a particular trend might or topic that has, you know, increased interest in the early parts of the trend. There may be only a few channels or a few videos about something. And so there might be high demand and low supply, so a lot of views per video. And then later there might be a lot more creators that are producing content in that area. And you might see more supply than demand. Yeah. And so those things are going to interact and will ultimately influence how much views there will be per video.
Another bit of advice that I really loved is you said, look at the subscription tab, because that's a way to see how your core audience is reacting without any involvement from the algorithm.
Right. So the way that works, the subscription tab, it's just a chronological feed of that viewer's channels that they've subscribed to. So it's a pretty consistent audience that's going into that tab to catch up on their subscriptions that doesn't have any sort of like dynamics of the recommendation system in it. And so why I encourage creators to look at that is because it's kind of a controlled little area. And then you can look at like, well, what is the click-through rate and what is the average view duration of subscribers who are looking for those videos in their feed. And it can give you a little bit more of a benchmark to kind of on the content in an apples to apples.
Yeah. Is it me or is it the algorithm?
I would just look at it, compare your videos. It can help you understand, oh, well, people aren't clicking on this in the subscriptions feed as much as they did my last video. What can I learn from that?
Yeah.
Maybe it's the thumbnail or the intro to the video.
Or the topic's not as broadly appealing. Because I think sometimes people forget that, like, you can only, you'll recommend a video to an audience, but some videos naturally have a smaller audience than other videos, or they have a much, like, more narrow focus, or just the broadness of appeal is different.
That's right.
Earlier this year, some of the talks that we did at, like, VidSummit and VidCon, you mentioned bringing more large language models into recommendations. How is that working?
Yeah, so for those of you who have played around with Gemini or ChatGPT or some of these other chatbots, the technology behind them is a large language model. We've applied the large language model technology to recommendations at YouTube to attempt to make them more relevant to viewers. How does this work? In a couple different ways. One, because the models are larger, and what that enables them to do is develop a deeper, more nuanced understanding of content and of each viewer. And so rather than just kind of like understanding like, oh, this video is about, you know, Indian cooking, it might actually be able to understand the ingredients of the dish better and maybe some more elements of the video style and how it's presented or the emotions that the creator might be conveying. These are all things that a larger model could enable. Smaller models tend to rely a lot on what we call memorization.
Okay.
So it might memorize that this video tends to be good with this type of viewer, for example. Whereas a larger language model can learn a more generalized pattern of, rather than just like this single video with this audience, it's like, oh, this type of video and this, and the patterns could be much more nuanced. So to use an analogy here, taking the cooking example, A small model that's memorizing is kind of like a cook that is reading from a recipe. It's like a fixed set of instructions, and I'm going to make this this dish. And, you know, the fact that I can execute those instructions doesn't necessarily mean I'm an expert chef. So the more generalized, you know, larger model would be more like an expert chef that can not only follow recipes, but understands the fundamentals behind cooking, and they can more dynamically respond to different conditions. So like, rather than just following the recipe, well, what happens if somebody comes in and they say, oh, I'm allergic to that ingredient, or I don't eat meat.
Yeah.
And now you still have to serve them up a dish. The chef, who has more nuanced understanding, will know what ingredients to substitute that are still going to make a delicious dish. So that's how I kind of think about this new technology enabling our better recommendations. We want to be more like the expert chef and less like the, you know, just following the memorized recipe.
Todd, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoy talking with you.
It's great to be here, and keep the feedback coming. So if you have feedback for me or the team, please put it in the comments, and I promise I'll read them.
And keep it real. Keep it real.